Testing 1, 2, 3, testing 1, 2, 3, ha 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 ha. Welcome to Curmudgeon's Corner for Saturday, November 2nd, 2019. I'm Sam Minter, and there is no Yvonne Bo today. There is no anybody today except me. I'm all alone. This is the first time I've been all alone doing the podcast in, I think, years. Because I've had co-host after co-host after co-host. And, you know, so here's what happened this time. A couple hours from recording the show on Friday night U.S. time, and Yvonne Bo texts me. He's sick. His son is sick. He was going to try to record the show and tough it out, but he decided he just couldn't do it. So it was only a couple hours before we were recording, so chances of getting a substitute were pretty low. I was like, hey, I guess I'll... I reached out on our Curmudgeon's Corner Slack, but nobody was available on such short notice, either for Friday night or for Saturday morning. I talked to my wife. She was willing to do it. But my son's best friend is over for a sleepover weekend, and they're dealing with stuff like that. And so Friday night, we did stuff with the kids. Saturday morning, which is when I'm recording this now, my wife is dealing with getting the kids breakfast and all that kind of stuff. And I said, just do that. I will do a solo show. It's been years, but I will do it again. And so apologies to any, well, we may have new listeners since the last time I did a solo show. So you don't know what it's like. But if it's not your thing, I understand. Just flip to next week. We will have two people on yammering, and it's a better dynamic. Well, I shouldn't say it's a better dynamic. It's just very, very different when you have two people talking to each other versus one person just going on and on and on and on and on like I'm doing right now, this very second. In any case, we do have an agenda for today. At about this point, I always say, because it's just me, it's going to be a really short show. And then it ends up not being. So I'm not going to say anything like that. It'll be what it is. Because I've amazed myself at my ability to just keep talking and talking and talking and talking, even though it's just me. Anyway, the agenda. 4 segments today. 1, an update on election 2020. And that'll have 2 subparts. 1, talking about my election graph site and where things are looking in terms of the general election for the various matchups and how that's going. And then a little bit about the primary process and what's going on with the Democrats right now. Then, of course, we will talk about the impeachment developments. I don't think it's possible to avoid that these days. I want to say it's slowed down, but it's just morphing as it's going along. It's not so much that it's slowed down. It's that we're getting used to this going on. But we'll talk a little bit about where that's going and all that sort of stuff. Then another thing that came up this week was the whole notion of political ads on Facebook and Twitter, because Twitter announced they weren't going to take any political ads. Facebook, of course, a couple weeks ago said they are taking political ads and they won't fact check them. So what's going on here? What are the implications of all this and all that? And then finally, I'll talk a little bit about local elections. And that's the plan. So we might as well jump right into the first one with the 2020 election. So I just, a few hours before recording the show, published the latest update on election graphs. For those of you who want to look, you can go to electiongraphs.com. It's the blog post published November 2nd, titled Harris and Buttigieg Struggling in Trump Matchups. And this is the big theme right now, over the last few weeks, is that when you look at these, and just as a level set, for those of you who haven't heard me do this before, electiongraphs.com looks only at state poll averages. So it looks at the general election matchups for, Trump versus Biden, Trump versus Sanders, Trump versus Warren, et cetera, and tries to then use those in each of the available states to project out what the national picture looks like. And I talk about, it tracks all the candidate combinations that have gotten polls at all. But I look at and talk about most the candidate combinations that have been polled the most, where there's decent data. Now, even now, to be honest, even with our best polled candidate combinations, there are many, many states that don't have any polls at all. So, for instance, I'm looking at Sanders versus Trump right now. And I do generally speaking, a 5-poll average, last 5 polls. If there are not yet 5 polls, then I start pulling in older election results. So I'll look at the 2016 election, the 2012 election, 2008, et cetera, going back until I can get the 5 that I need. That gives a baseline based on actual historical results so that, for instance, before there's any polling at all in Wyoming, we can already know Wyoming's a deep red state, right? Nobody's expecting that to change. So we base it off the old elections until we have data. So we've got enough for, looking again at Sanders versus Trump as an example, we've got the whole 5 polls and a bunch of, the states you'd think, Ohio, Texas, North Carolina, Michigan, Wisconsin, et cetera. But Florida, there's only been 3 polls. Colorado, there's only been 1. Virginia, there's only been 2. And then, of course, you're like I said, Wyoming. Nobody's pulled Wyoming yet. Everybody knows what's going to happen in Wyoming. So, but a lot, we still have imperfect polling data, but we've got enough that for the major candidates, we've got a decent sort of picture of what's going on. There are places that I would really like more polls. Like I'm very curious about Georgia, for instance. And for most of the candidate pairs, there's no data there yet. In any case, what we have right now is a picture where let's look at the 5 top Democrats right now in terms of, both in terms of the primary polling, but also in terms of how much they've been polled about the general election. And that would be Sanders, Warren, Biden, Harris, and Buttigieg. Those are really the top tier right now. And that's being a little generous. Like if you look at the Real Clear Politics average for the national polls, there's spacing between them now. Biden is clearly in first. Warren is clearly in second. Sanders is clearly in third. Buttigieg is clearly in fourth. And Harris is clearly in fifth. And then you have another gap. And then you have everybody else who's still running is all bunched up together. If you wanted to strain it, you could sort of separate out, some of those, but not really. They're all just in a blob at the bottom there. Fine, maybe Yang, Klobuchar. You don't even want to do that. There's the top 5, and then there's everybody else. But when you look at those top 5 in the general election matchups, and again, I'm not looking at national polls here. That's not how we do elections, although you do see a similar patterns in the national polls. But when you're looking at this state data, we now basically have 3 tiers. And that's winning decisively is what I call the top tier. And that's Biden and Sanders. Right now, on election graphs, I do this categorization thing where, there's weak states, strong states, solid states. And I basically say the weak states can go back and forth however they want. And that's the model I've used for several election cycles now. But I've also now got a probabilistic model where I, using the election results in the last 3 election cycles that I've done this, computed basically like, if the polls say candidate X is ahead by 2.3%, what are the chances of them actually winning And this is based on the final poll averages right before election day versus the actual election results. And I computed all that and I do a Monte Carlo simulation. Now, to be clear, an important part that I always say when I talk about these is all of this represents if the election was held today. The election is not held today. It's still over a year away. As I am recording this, 367.3 days remain until polls start to close on election day. But the top tier, the Democrats who are clearly way ahead, and that's Biden and Sanders. Right now, I have Biden at a 99.98% chance of winning based on where his state polls are, and Sanders not far behind at 98.3. Now, in both of these cases, again, it's so important to say the election is not today. A lot can change. And specifically, the general election battle is not really engaged yet. And I suspect these kinds of 99.999999% chance of winning, I don't feel like that's going to survive into the actual general election. When you have, for instance, in the Trump-Biden matchup, when you have Trump directly attacking Biden every day and everything in play that's going to be there. So Biden's at 100% in my model right now. But do I believe it's going to stay that way? No, I really don't. But it does show that he and Sanders are both in very strong positions right now. And part of that is that they are competitive or ahead in a lot of states that have not been blue in the past. I'm looking at Arizona. I'm looking at Texas. North Carolina is also one that it did go blue for Obama a couple years ago. But if the Democrat is leading Texas, that already gives you, it changes the picture of the election dramatically. Texas is huge. It has a lot of electoral votes. That changes things. Now, this is another place. Do I believe that even though Biden and Sanders are both leading Texas at the moment, that they will be when we come to next summer or next fall? I'm not sure I do. I'm not sure I believe that, but it's where the polls have them right now. But meanwhile, the Democrats in the other tiers don't have that. So let me get to the next tier, which is Warren. Who I classify as, what did I call it here? Leading, but narrowly. Right now, I have her at a 73.1% chance of winning. And if you look at what that looks like, she's behind in Texas. She's behind in Arizona. She's behind in North Carolina. She's behind in Ohio. She's behind in Pennsylvania. But she's just barely behind in all of those states. And she's just slightly leading in Florida. And that puts her at a very narrow win with the possibility of picking up a couple of those states where she's just barely behind. And when you mix that all up together in a probabilistic model, it gives her about a 70% chance of winning. But all of these states that I just rattled off, Pennsylvania, Ohio, North Carolina, Texas, Arizona, these are all states that Biden is just ahead in. And Sanders is ahead in most of them as well. But Warren is not. Warren is behind in all of those states. Just a little bit behind, but still behind. And then finally, we have Democrats who are a coin toss. Harris and Buttigieg. Harris right now has a 54.6% chance of winning in my model. Buttigieg is actually below 50% right now at 46.0%. And if you look at them on where they are on these states that I've been mentioning, they're, again, behind in these states like Arizona, Texas, North Carolina, Florida, Ohio, etc. They're behind in these states, but they're behind by more. Whereas it was very narrow for Warren. These guys are behind further in these states. And it's a little bit different on each one, right? Harris and Buttigieg are actually both ahead slightly in Pennsylvania. They're also, another factor is they're states like Michigan, for instance, which are blue in all of these models, but the margin is a lot less for these last two candidates, for Buttigieg and Harris, compared to some of the others. And so there's more states that are just barely blue that could flip. And so where does this put us? There's this whole battle, I shouldn't say battle, but there's this debate on the Democratic side about electability and where that should factor into decisions on who to vote for in the primary process. And there's one side of things that says, you know, they're all electable. They all could win, and they absolutely all could win. But we're clearly seeing at this point differences where the spectrum within the Democrats really is, at this point, from Joe Biden and Sanders, who the polling is saying are very, very strong against Trump and will almost certainly win. Now, again, my caveat, I don't really believe that almost certainly will survive into the general election. I think they'll weaken from here. To the other end of the spectrum, where it really is a coin toss. I mean, we're talking 55%, 45%. That's as close as to a coin toss as you're going to get with these things. Yeah. They could win. They could also very easily lose. And Warren somewhere in between. Now, I've mentioned this kind of stuff on the show before. And the big question is, yeah, but can you believe this stuff yet? Is this real? We're still, you know, we're still early in the process. A lot of people aren't paying attention yet, aren't understanding, you know, how much of this is just name recognition. And, you know, I've been saying for a while that, you know, early on, it's clearly name recognition. Okay, Biden and Sanders are doing better because everybody knows who Biden and Sanders are. Warren's probably second because, you know, of these five that we're talking about, she's the third best known of these candidates. And so maybe this is all name recognition. A lot of experts, you say, look, that's one of the reasons you don't pay attention to these general election polls right now is it's all about name recognition. People won't say yes to the candidate they know very little about. And Harris and Buttigieg fall into that category. And I've sort of been saying, yeah, I very much buy that in the early stages. But come on, we're 1 year out now. Surely that name recognition thing is fading at this point. And for the most part, people know who these folks are. But no. If you're listening to this show, you're a political junkie and you keep track of these things and you know who Harris is. But a few days ago, I was at work and I mentioned something about my election graph site and the person asked, well, how things are going and who do I like and blah, 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 blah. And as part of that discussion, I mentioned Harris. And this person's response was, Harris, who's he? Never heard of him. And I said, well, she actually. And he's like, oops, guess I really never heard of him. So I had, she's a senator from California, blah, 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 blah. But, you know, to me, as someone who pays attention to this stuff closely, look, I can understand if you don't know who Bullock is, you know, or Delaney or Bennett or Williamson. I barely know who those folks are myself, and I keep track of it. I had to flip to the RCP page to make sure I got their names right when I was saying that just then, you know. But it's almost unimaginable to me that someone wouldn't know who someone is who's in the top five, who's, you know, okay, Harris is sort of faded. She's, you know, not doing as well in the campaign as many people anticipated that she would do. But still, she's in the top five. She's one of the major contenders. She has been all along. But, you know, real people with real lives who aren't political junkies, a lot of them still don't know who she is. And I'm sure the same thing is true of Buttigieg. You know, people just don't know who they are. Because the alternate theory people have put out is, of course, well, the straight white men, the straight white old men are at the top and are doing well. The white woman's doing a little bit less well, but the black woman and the gay guy, they're the ones who aren't doing well. And so surely this is some sort of prejudicial, you know, America's not ready for these kind of demographics kind of thing. And I'm not sure. I honestly want a few more months to play out. When we get to Iowa, I will do this kind of look at things again and see if we're still where we are. Because right now, you know, both theories could potentially apply because of the way things are lining up, right? On the one hand, yeah, nobody knows Harrison Buttigieg. You know, I, again, not nobody, obviously, but you shouldn't underestimate the name recognition effect. I mean, the person I was talking to at work, you know, an educated person in a professional white-collar job, someone you would expect to know what's up. But no, because this just isn't their focus. This isn't something they're thinking about on a day-to-day basis. So they don't know these names. And I think that's true of a surprisingly large group of people, at least surprising for people like us who pay attention to this stuff. It's like, how could you not know this? But a lot of people just don't care. And they're actually actively trying to ignore this stuff for as long as they possibly can. So name recognition is a real factor. I've seen people online, not a few months ago, not recently, but I do some correlations where they looked at the national polling in these head-to-heads of various candidates against Donald Trump and lined it up against name recognition for each of these people. And there was a direct correlation. Basically, the greater your name recognition, the better you did against Trump. That simple. And so I definitely believe that's out there. On the other hand, it's very easy to say, well, this lines up quite nicely with the other thing, too. We're looking for the people who are going to do better against Trump. There are two theories of this, right? There's either people who can get out the Democratic base better, or there's people who can win back swing voters who went to Trump, but just barely in 2016. There's been a lot of research that says that getting out the voter who, the reluctant voter, and bringing out your base tends not to work as well. But it did apparently. That plus, you know, keeping liberals home in various ways did seem to work for Donald Trump. You know, between people on the left who were Bernie folks who didn't want to vote for Hillary, or people who just weren't that excited about Hillary, or people who were sure that Hillary was going to win and so that didn't bother. Between those people staying home and Trump exciting a certain Republican base who was never going to be excited by Jeb Bush's and Marco Rubio's and folks like that, there is something to that as well. But if you're going after the middle, the notion that, you know, Biden, for instance, is sort of a safe choice, that Obama to Trump voters could feel like going back to, say, oops, screwed up with Trump, sorry, but Biden's okay. He's not going to do anything really radical. He's safe. He's an old white man that looks like, okay, that's fine. I feel comfortable with that. The case for Sanders is a little different. He's safe in the old white man sort of sense, but you certainly can't say from a policy position he's moderate and he's not going to do crazy things. His whole campaign is premised on he's going to make radical change. But he shares some of the anti-establishment stuff with Donald Trump. And so you could easily see him getting those Trump voters. In the 2016 race, Yvonne and I talked quite a bit about how many people we were seeing out there that seemed to be saying things like, you know, their top two choices were Trump and Sanders, but they were having a hard time picking. The commonality is the blow up the system mindset, you know? So maybe you can see that there, but then you start looking at, okay, so all of these states that I was listing, the red states that were turning blue with Biden and Sanders, but that aren't with the rest of these folks, is it reluctance because Warren's a woman? Is it reluctance because Harris is black, or reluctance because Buttigieg is gay? I don't know. It's certainly a hypothesis worth testing. But what does that mean when you come time to make a decision? When my wife was on the show a couple weeks ago, we sort of had this debate in terms of, in the primary process, do you go with the one you love, or do you try to game out how they'll win in the general election or how they won't? I mentioned at the time that I feel like you kind of have to do the cost-benefit analysis and say, do I like, if this candidate has half the chance of the other one of winning, do I think they'd be twice as good to make up for that and in sort of the expected value calculation? I don't know. And then, of course, you have to factor in the cost of a Donald Trump win in that equation as well. And different people are going to come differently there. But the final thing I'll say about that, I should never say the final thing because it's never the final thing, right? So I talked about, you know, what's the potential explanation of where they are in the polls right now. But the other important thing is, will it change? And I touched on this when I said, like, I don't believe this 100% chance of a Biden win is going to survive into the general election. I think he'll go down, because when you enter into that general election, he's going to be attacked a lot more, and his flaws are going to be exposed more, etc. But the flip side of that is folks like Harris and Buttigieg, who are polling not that great against Donald Trump right now, but who aren't very well known, will become well known by winning. You will have a rally around the flag effect on Democrats who right now are like, who are those guys? I don't know. If they actually won, they would be potentially more enthused about them. And you'd get the, well, I wasn't my favorite, but we have to beat Trump kind of effect as well. And so I suspect that these people who aren't doing quite as well would actually do better than where they are right now if they actually won the nomination. But that's highly speculative, right? So the question is anything we're talking about now even worth talking about? And right now, as we sit at the beginning of November, a year before the presidential election, I'd say that this pattern, this, you know, Biden and Sanders doing really well, Warren doing and Buttigieg and Harris being coin tosses, is an interesting pattern to watch, to see if it changes over time. We've had some form of this pattern almost since the beginning of state-by-state polling for the 2020 election. Biden has always been way ahead of the others. I think the new thing is the separation of the rest into these tiers. Sanders has almost caught up with Biden, and Buttigieg and Harris have been falling. And I think it's interesting to watch that. It's interesting to see. I'm going to be paying very close attention to how this develops over the next few months. But would I base election decisions on it when it comes time to doing primary votes on the Democratic side? Maybe. You know, as we get close to those times, it's going to change between now and the Iowa caucus. And after the Iowa caucus, that'll scramble things again. But will I personally be factoring quote-unquote electability into my primary decisions? Yes, I will be. Not in the sense of, this guy looks electable, but in terms of these kinds of numbers where you're looking at the head-to-head matches against Donald Trump. And I won't make a distinction. Like, if there's close, if like somebody's at 80% and somebody's at 70%, really that's essentially the same thing. But if somebody has a 90% chance of winning and somebody else has a 10% chance of winning, damn Skippy, I'm paying attention to that. And even if it's a difference between 90% and 50%, yes, I'm paying attention to that. I'm factoring it into the decisions with other things. It's not necessarily going to be the only thing I look at, but I'm definitely going to be looking at that. And I think people in general should. I think that actually matters. The counter argument relates to what I just said about things changing, that even when we get to February or March, these kinds of head-to-head matchups against Donald Trump will change wildly before you get to next November. And so why pay attention to them? Because it's all going to change anyway. But I think it does, even if things are going to change, where things are now tells you how much they have to change to make a difference. And so I think it's worth looking at. I was also going to talk a little bit about Harris's struggles overall, about Biden dropping in all the early states and sort of betting on later states and how the early states could toss everything up. But I think I've been going long enough on this topic of 2020. We'll talk more about those things another time, because there's definitely interesting dynamics going on in the early states right now, and it's worth paying attention to. I think this more of a toss-up than people think right now. I mean, yes, I guess, fine, I'm talking about it. Nationally, Biden's been ahead in number one almost this entire time. There was a very brief point where Warren peaked in the RCP poll average above Biden, but she dropped back down again. And right now we have that clear 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 ranking that I mentioned before. But that's the national, and we don't do things nationally. We have Iowa and New Hampshire and Nevada and South Carolina. And if you look at those, Iowa has Warren decently ahead, and then Buttigieg, Biden, and Sanders basically in a tie for second place, and then everybody else way, way, way far behind. And keep in mind, in the Democratic primaries as well, there's a 15% threshold for getting any delegates. That means, like, if you come in at 10%, you get nothing. And you look at Iowa first, and everything potentially changes after Iowa. If you remember in 2008, Iowa is where the tide changed between Clinton and Obama. This has happened in a number of other situations as well. And that's why you have Harris going all in on Iowa right now. It doesn't seem to be working right now. She's in sixth place in Iowa. But that's why the strategy is, like, if you can make a pop in Iowa, then it can change everything. There have been candidates who've been nowhere in the national polls, but come in second or third in Iowa, and then everybody takes a fresh look at them, and they end up doing very well afterwards. I think even winning. I think that was the John Kerry story, was roughly what I just said. So right now we basically have, you know, we've still got a couple months till Iowa, but we've got a lot of players in Iowa still. Sanders is still in it. Biden is fading. Warren is winning. Buttigieg is on her, you know, right behind her though. And then in New Hampshire, again, we have Warren, again, we have Biden fading. We have Sanders on the rise in New Hampshire, and then we've got a big gap and everybody else, you know, Harris is fifth, but just barely ahead of Yang. Everybody else is down there in that group. And between Iowa and New Hampshire, everything gets scrambled. And then you finally have Biden looking like he's still in decent shape in Nevada and South Carolina. And that's his firewall. And that's his strategy right now. It seems to be, okay, fine. I'll lose Iowa and New Hampshire. I'll come back in Nevada and South Carolina. That is not a strategy that's worked well for people in the past. But maybe he can pull it off. We'll see. I mean, what's happened in the past is if you lose Iowa and New Hampshire, people write you off and say, well, guess he's a loser. And then you plummet and you fail. So this kind of strategy has not worked for people before. But we've also got lots of time for Biden to come back in Iowa and New Hampshire. Or for somebody to come out of nowhere, like, you know, Klobuchar or Harris coming back and, you know, making some headway in Iowa and making a surprising showing. And then that changes things. We got a long way to go. Okay, that's that. Let's take a break. And I will come back with a little bit about what's next. The impeachment stuff. Yay. Back after this.
Ready for the test, Dracula?
I'm ready. Frankenstein, then. Let us begin.
Creepy Classic celebrates the classic horror and science fiction films from the silent era through the 1960s, and retro TV horror from the 1950s to the 1970s. Visit creepyclassics.com for all your classic video needs. And when you buy something, tell Ron that the curmudgeons say hello.
Okay, we are back. Or should I say I am back? Because it's just me. Or I guess it's you if you're listening too. So we are back. And it's time to talk about impeachment. Now, I'll start right off by saying I do not have a set of detailed notes in front of me about all the names and the people who testified and all of those developments. If you want that kind of stuff, go listen to Rachel Maddow or somebody who will take you through all the names and all the connections and all this blah, 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 and, you know, all those kinds of details. I'm going to try to keep it at a higher level than that right now, which is just what's the overall tenor of the changes that have happened in the last week on this. The major development was obviously that Nancy Pelosi called the bluff of the Republicans who've been asking for process changes and saying, this is not a real impeachment inquiry because the House hasn't taken a vote, blah, 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 blah. And as I said, the very moment, I was actually just re-listening to the show on the week that Nancy Pelosi announced her support of the impeachment investigations. And I commented then, look, the thing is, at any moment, from this point forward, Nancy Pelosi can decide to have that vote if she wants it, and she can pick the timing to maximize her advantage in that. And so what she did was essentially let the Republicans pound their fists on the table about this process argument for a month or so, and then say, here you go. Here's the vote. And so now that's done. That takes that off the table. And now the Republicans have to figure out another argument to make. Now, the argument so far is, well, now it's an unfair process. But they gave them, everything that Clinton had in his impeachment, everything that Nixon had in his impeachment. And there you go. Could they have bent over backwards even further? Sure, they probably could have. But why? So they did this. It formalizes a few things. I almost feel like they had to do it at some point. They could have potentially done this in the committee too, as opposed to on the floor. The biggest change is for open hearings, switching from the 5 minute per side to allowing up to 45 minutes per side when they go back and forth, and allowing staff to do that questioning. This is something that was clearly needed, from some of what we saw, a couple months ago with the Mueller testimony, with the Lewandowski testimony, the 5 minute to a side thing with just the members doing questioning is just stupid and idiotic and bad. So that was a change that needed to be made. And, you know, some other things, allowing the president's lawyers to be at certain places, allowing a few other things, but keeping the control with the majority. So obviously the Republicans would love if they were just given equal access to everything and blah, blah, blah. The Democrats were not about to do that. So in terms of testimony that had this, that happened this last week, we basically got more and more confirmation of all the badness that appeared to be in place ever since this Ukraine memo leaked. And, you know, it just fleshing out details of who saw what when, who was pushing who to do what, all this kind of stuff. And the Republicans really are being pushed into a corner in terms of what their defense of the president has to be. Because they've been doing this process stuff, you know, they've been ignoring the substance as long as they could and talking about process. That's kind of taken off the table. They also, for a while, were going on about, maybe something was going on there, but there was no quid pro quo. Now, how the Democrats allowed themselves to even let that be part of the discussion, I don't know. That's one, because again, you didn't need a quid pro quo to have unethical behavior, even illegal behavior with the campaign finance stuff. You didn't even need that in place, but the debate started to be about, is there a quid pro quo? And the Republicans were saying, well, there may have been something here, but there was no quid pro quo. And then you got more and more evidence that, well, yeah, there was a quid pro quo. So now the Republicans are having to step back from that. And they really are left at this point at, yeah, he did it, so what? That is where we are right now. And that's kind of where it seemed, it was almost inevitable that that's where things would end up. I mean, it's where Donald Trump was from day one, pretty much. It's just taken congressional Republicans a little bit of time to catch up because they wanted to be like, well, it didn't happen. Or there was no quid pro quo, and that's what matters, and blah, blah, blah. But no, Donald Trump has said pretty much all along. I mean, when he went out in front of the cameras and said, yes, I asked Ukraine to look into Joe Biden. And by the way, China, why don't you look too? He's basically saying, yes, I do this. Yes, I'm doing it right here in front of cameras, and there's nothing wrong with it. And that puts the debate there. So there's no credible, he didn't do it. The question is just, was he wrong to do it? And even if he was wrong to do it, does it rise to an impeachable issue? Is it worth removing a president over? And so this is where we now have Republicans. Yes, there was a quid pro quo. And then we have a little bit of a division between, and that was wrong, he shouldn't have done it, but it's not impeachable, versus the folks who are really all out, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's how business is supposed to be done. This is how, you know, it's within the president's prerogative to do this. And it seems like that's where things are shaping up. You know, again, absent new revelations, there seem to be new revelations all the time. This week, just like each of the previous few weeks, there have been a few new revelations about details of how this was happening and who was doing what and how and blah, 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 and specifically some of the things that Trump was doing. At some point, will some of those make a difference? Maybe. There's also a significant danger that it just becomes part of the drone of, oh, yeah, Trump's doing stuff. Yeah, he always does stuff. That's just him. I mean, some of the Republicans talking about this specifically did, you know, this is Trump's style. This is how he operates. What do you guys expect? You know, basically. And so the question is, at what point do you take the norms of behavior and apply them here? Another danger that I noticed in some of the debate this week is some of the folks testifying who have, you know, are career people who are involved in the White House policy process have said things like they became concerned that the president was doing things to undermine U.S. policy, okay. But here's the thing. It's the president's job to define what that policy is. So, for instance, there's a difference between talking about, hey, the president went and used the power of the U.S. government to solicit a foreign government's help on something whose only purpose was to benefit his own campaign for president. This is the corruption and misuse of power that is the impeachable offense. This is the, you know, when the founders put together impeachment, one of the primary things they were worried about was, you know, basically rogue, corrupt actors in the presidency doing things on their own behalf or potentially on behalf of foreign powers. That was another issue they were concerned about. But from the pure policy point of view, it seemed like some of these people who were testifying, their concern was not necessarily that pure corruption of, hey, I'm using American foreign policy to advocate my personal goals. It was more, hey, wait a second. This person doesn't seem to be carrying out the policy that has gone on for years about being confrontational with the Russians over Ukraine. Like, the worry was that we were going to abandon the Ukrainians to Russian influence. You know, we were going to abandon the Ukrainians and the Russians would be able to make military gains, whatever. Well, you may or may not disagree with the notion, but the president could say tomorrow, I recognize Russia's annexation of Crimea. And by the way, if they want the rest of eastern Ukraine, I have no objections to that either. We're not getting involved. That's kind of what he did with the Kurds. But the president can do that unless there are legal things that are enshrined by Congress into, you know, policy issues that are enshrined by Congress that tie the president's hands. In most of these cases, or treaties, in most of these cases, the president has a lot of discretion. They can do that stuff. So I think the Democrats have to be very careful about that line. And some of their witnesses are threatening to drag them over that line, where the issue that's like the concern that the witness is bringing up is a concern about Donald Trump changing American foreign policy, as opposed to the concern about Donald Trump misusing presidential power for personal goals. Now, obviously, these two are connected, right? Like, if the reason Donald Trump is changing American foreign policy is to advocate his own personal goals, well, now they're all connected. But I just got the sense from some of the reports of the testimony that some of these witnesses really, whether or not it was going to benefit Donald Trump, wasn't their main concern. Their main concern was not screwing the Ukrainians. Now, I'm concerned about that too. I don't want to screw the Ukrainians, but if you're talking impeachable offense versus policy difference, there's an important distinction there. And so I think the Democrats have to be careful along those lines, because the last thing they want is to let there be a credible case that this isn't about anything impeachable. This isn't about wrongdoing. This is just a policy difference, because that weakens their case significantly. Even if you're on an issue where the majority of congressional Republicans actually disagree with Donald Trump, although that part doesn't hurt. Like, the fact that he's had this whole thing with the Kurds did not strengthen him with congressional Republicans. Now, the final bit to talk about is the perennial topic of, well, do we see any more cracks? Are there any Republicans crossing over? Well, the one test of that with the vote in the House on the new rules on impeachment, there were no Republican defectors, unless you count Amash, who left the Republican Party over this issue. And there were, in fact, two Democrats who voted against it with the Republicans. So we certainly don't see the cracks in any sort of voting at this point. Now, having said that, I let's put it this way. If you were a House Republican who thought that the impeachment inquiry actually was legit, and I'm not saying there are many of these folks, the House Republicans are fairly solidly on their sides of the fence. The House in general, the Democrats are on their side, the Republicans on their side. There's very little middle ground in the House. But let's just hypothetically say you were a Republican who were like, yeah, this deserves investigation. We need to start this process. Look into it. Reserve judgment on the actual impeachment itself, but you wanted to do this. You know it's going to pass with Democratic votes. You know it'll hurt you politically if you make that vote. Your vote will not make a difference to that. You keep quiet. You keep your powder dry. Maybe if the evidence is overwhelming, you might vote for the impeachment down the line. But even then, in the House, I don't think you would, because that doesn't make a difference. The fundamental dynamic in both the House and the Senate is on the Republican side, Donald Trump is still heavily, heavily supported by the people who vote in Republican primaries. That has not changed. There's been a slight erosion. There's been a slight erosion, but I emphasize slight. Like his approval among Republicans has dropped from the low 90s to the high 80s, maybe. Okay. There's been a slight erosion, but nowhere near the kind of movement that would give congressional Republicans cover. Basically, any Republican in Congress knows with a fairly high degree of certainty at this point that if they go against the president on impeachment at any level, whether it's authorizing an investigation or final conviction in the Senate or anything in between, if they go against the president, their career as a Republican is over. They will lose in a primary for the next time they're up for election, and most likely they won't have a space in sort of the non-elected Republican ecosystem either. Like, there's this whole money-making ecosystem of lobbyists and commentators and all this kind of other stuff that people who retire from Congress often go into. But a Republican congressperson who goes against Trump is likely to be excluded from that, unless or until the group of people who are Republican primary voters start to turn against Donald Trump, that calculus remains the same. And so any Republican elected official who openly goes against Donald Trump is giving up their career. And maybe some will do that. But frankly, if you did have some sort of principled stance on that, you would want to save it to where it would make a difference. Which means if you're in the House and you know this is going to win anyway, you shut up. You don't say a thing. You let the Democrats do what they're going to do, and you are glad that it happens because you wish that you think that's the right thing to happen, but you don't have to put yourself on the line for it. The only place where that calculation changes at all is once you're in a Senate trial. Then maybe you have some Republican senators that, if they really and truly believe Donald Trump should be gone, who are willing to give up the rest of their careers. People who are thinking about retiring anyway, people who think that they could potentially win as an independent and leave the Republican Party to do this. Yeah, those sorts of folks, you know, and I don't know that there are very many of them. Again, this whole equation, I think it's actually true that if there was a group of Republican leaders in Congress who decided to take this stand, they could actually move a significant chunk of Republican public opinion, because just like we were talking about with Pelosi and impeachment, it's self-reinforcing. There are a lot of people out there who are taking their cues from the leadership, and if the leadership changes position, they will too. However, I don't doubt that it's a losing position for a Republican to go against Donald Trump right now. So these folks, there's nobody willing to sort of go out on that limb and be that leader to say, you know, yes, I'm a Republican, but Donald Trump does suck. let's go get Pence. There's nobody willing to be a leader on that. They are all looking super, super carefully at the polls to see if anything changes. And so far, nothing's changing. If you look at the job approval numbers on Real Clear Politics, Donald Trump, the net approval, so approval minus disapproval, still is at negative 11.5%, which is right smack in the middle of the same range that it's been in all the way since somewhere around the spring of 2018. It bounces up, it bounces down. It's basically been between negative 5 and negative 15 for a year and a half, bouncing up and down within that range. In some of my discussions on the Curmudgeon's Corner Slack, I said basically, look, I will raise my eyebrows if that net approval goes below negative 15. By the way, negative 15 is the trailing 1 year minimum. Like, that's the worst Donald Trump has been in the last 52 weeks, is negative 15. So I will raise my eyebrows if it gets worse than that. His all-time low is negative 20. I will really start to pay attention and think something might be going on here if he breaks that negative 20 level. But he's at negative 11.5 right now, which is right smack in the middle of where he's been all along. Nothing is changing anybody's mind so far. You know, it's bouncing around in the same range it's always bounced around. And maybe the next big stage on this is sometime in the next few weeks, we'll be moving to public hearings. And, you know, that's the kind of thing that can sometimes move stuff. It can be dramatic. It can be whatever. But we're so polarized at this point. You know, I don't know. I don't know. But clearly, you know, Donald Trump got to negative 20 before. Seems like we could get there again. I mean, it happened. So we shall see. It's very interesting to watch day over day, week over week, what the developments are. I keep waiting for more shoes to drop because it still feels like there's more out there. However, it kind of feels like we know pretty much the picture on what went on the Ukraine stuff right now. And in the end, it really is going to come down to, do folks think this kind of behavior is okay? Forget the legalities. Do they think it's okay or understandable? And I think there are a lot of folks out there, perhaps even most of the Republicans, who are like, yeah, so what? So what? Now, would they be saying so what if it was a Democrat? No, of course not. Because it's all about, like, is it your guy? But still. And could I imagine that some of the Democrats would change their mind if it was a Democrat? You know? Would they believe the argument that, oh, he's really just interested in corruption? He's not actually going after Joe Biden. It's not actually about getting stuff for his reelection. It's not actually about trying to prove that 2016 wasn't influenced by the Russians. It's not none of that. He's just really after corruption. He hates corruption. You know, would we believe that if it was a Democrat saying it? I don't think I would. But would some people? Sure. Anyway, enough on that. We'll see what happens. We'll take another break. We will be back talking about political ads on Facebook and Twitter after this.
Facebook, Facebook, Facebook!
Hey, do you want to help support Curmudgeon's Corner? Well, right now, the best way is through Facebook. If you haven't already liked us on Facebook and you actually, well, like us, then go search for Curmudgeon's Corner on Facebook and like our page. It will help you see when we announce new episodes and it'll help us reach more new people too. If you like a particular episode, like our episode announcement post too, or share it with your friends. All of this helps spread the word about our podcast to more people who might like it as well. And of course, we love having a conversation with all of you listeners, so please use Facebook to leave comments on the shows, give us suggestions, or anything else like that. It's always great to hear from you. So, if you want to help the show,
use Facebook. Or forget all of that and just send us money.
Okay, I'm back. So time for political ads on Facebook and Twitter and all of this kind of stuff. What should the social media platforms be doing? What are the implications for free speech? What about legacy stuff, TV ads and all this kind of stuff? How does it all fit together? So Facebook, a couple weeks ago, came out with a controversial announcement that they changed their policy. They had a policy in place that said that advertisements could be removed if they were factually incorrect. And I don't know how good a job they did at policing this. Probably not very good. But they had this policy in place. So if there was an ad out there and then someone pointed out or they discovered or whatever that it was just flat out lying, then that ad could be removed. And so this applied in the non-political space. So, you know, you've got your ad for your favorite box of breakfast cereal, and it tells you that if you eat it, you'll get superpowers. Well, you could potentially have that removed. But they changed that rule to exempt political ads. They basically said, look, we don't want to be in the business of regulating political speech. And if a politician lies, then it's up to the public, third parties, news organizations, whatever, to point that out. That's not our job. We don't want that to be our job. We don't want to be in that business. Do you really want Facebook in there evaluating political ads for truthfulness and squashing the ones that tell lies? I mean, look, you know, politicians are known for stretching the truth, right? I mean, even before we had Donald Trump on his like 10 lies a day pace, or even more than that, whatever it is these days, politicians were not exactly known for being the most honest of creatures in the universe. Do you really want Facebook doing that? And so they said, you know, we're going to step out of that. And so then, of course, people, you know, Elizabeth Warren was trying to make a point about this. You know, she put out an ad with some lies about Zuckerberg and said, you know, blah, blah, blah. There was another organization that put out, I believe it was a doctored video of Lindsey Graham talking about how he loved the Green New Deal. And then that guy had his video removed. Well, that guy declared himself to be a candidate for the governor of California, I believe, so that he would be a politician and his ads would be protected. Then Facebook was like, no, you're not a real politician, and took his ad down anyway. So now we've got Facebook not only deciding, they may not be deciding the truth of the ad, but they're deciding who's really a politician or not. How is this going to end well? You know, this. So Facebook was clearly in a weird position with all of this. And look, this stuff is complicated. You know, in terms of defining policies around this, enforcing them in a just way, enforcing them at scale. I mean, that's one of the big problems here. It's just physically impossible to like scale, to have human beings look at all the traffic that's going on something like Facebook or Twitter. So you have to have some automated gates and some things that are looked at by humans and some things that aren't. It's a mess. It's complicated. Having consistency is hard. Doing it in such a way that doesn't introduce unintentional biases is hard. And Facebook was knee deep into this mess when Twitter came around and was like, okay, then we're just not going to take any political ads whatsoever. And that'll solve our problem. Well, maybe. A lot of people were really excited by this and saying, yes, this is a good move. This is what Twitter should do. Let's not have things distorted by political ads in this way. But then a number of people pointed out flaws with this as well. One is the same thing we were talking about with Facebook a second ago. Well, how do you define what's a political ad and what's not? Like, if I'm going to talk about, because they included issue ads, right? So fine, is anti-vax propaganda political? Does it get banned? If it does the actual scientific consensus about the usefulness of vaccines, does that also get banned? Because if the one side is banned, then the other side should be too, right? Is this a political issue? Is it not? Who gets to decide? Well, Twitter, I guess, but do they want to be in that business either? Also, if you ban all political ads, then it gives an advantage to anything that's an entrenched interest that already has lots of money. So because you can still advertise on TV, you can still advertise in newspapers. Does anybody read newspapers anymore? You can still advertise in other mass media. But Facebook and Twitter were both relatively cheap. So grassroots organizations could afford to do Facebook and Twitter advertising. People running in small local races could do Facebook and Twitter advertising and reach people that they would never reach otherwise. People could build new organizations and momentum through this kind of reach. Now, you know, and Twitter said, you know, basically, you know, people should earn that kind of reach. They shouldn't be able to buy it. Well, there's a cold start problem there, right? In terms of if you're starting with nothing, how do you get that initial attention? And that's actually really difficult. And maybe it should be. But on the other hand, if you really want a robust competition of ideas, maybe you need some way to sort of start by getting in front of people. Now, I posted on Twitter after this news came out, hey, I have an idea. How about just letting people pay for Twitter and Facebook, have a monthly subscription, and just show me the stuff from people who I've asked to see their stuff in order without messing with it and without inserting other people into it. Like, because, you know, really, like, I know that's not economically viable for either Twitter or Facebook, but from a user's point of view, that is 100% what I want. I don't want any freaking ads on my Facebook, on my Twitter. I don't want things pushed at me. I want to pick a set of people whose updates I want to see, and I want to see those updates. Done. Please, can I just have that? Now, you know, for Twitter, I use Tweetbot and I can still basically get exactly what I just described. Facebook, it's nearly impossible at this point to get something that's just straight out, show me the stuff from the people I follow. But here's another problem. The paid ads are the tip of the iceberg, especially on Twitter. Now, like on Facebook, paid ads were, you know, were part of what was manipulated in 2016. It's part of a whole bunch of politicians are just getting good at Facebook ads and targeting and being manipulative. And I'm not just talking Russian interference. I'm talking about native homegrown politicians getting good at this. On Twitter, the big problem is not the paid ads. The big problem is bots and harassment, but that's a different kind of issue. But the big problem is bots and manipulated campaigns of various sorts that are free. They're not paid ads, but it's people going in and using artificial mechanisms to inflate the influence of certain things through sort of part of it is bots, as I mentioned, but part of it is also just coordinated campaigns where there's groups of people who coordinate behind the scenes of we're going to push this on such and such date and make it trend and therefore blah, blah, blah. There's all kinds of manipulation going on that causes certain things to rise up and get attention and certain things not to. There all kinds of problems with social media, and on Twitter specifically, the paid ads aren't the big part of it. I can't remember if it was on Twitter or the Curmudgeon's Corner Slack, but I was talking to Yvonne about this. In terms of, well, you're mentioning all these downsides. Is that all that bad? Given all the negative effects we've seen of the political advertising on these forums, even with these costs, is it? What would you do? I don't know. What I'm pointing out is not necessarily that I know the right way to approach this. It's more that it's actually complicated. It's not simply political ads are bad. Banning them is good. There are a lot of potential unintended consequences here. And do I think where we have been over the last few years is a gigantic mess? Yes, I think it is. Do I think just saying not taking political ads is necessarily a solution? I don't know. I don't know. I see so many places where it could go wrong, where, you know, you're trying to get rid of political ads, but the actual result is causing problems for what should be legitimate political expression, sort of throwing the baby out with the bathwater kind of cliche. But yeah, I mean, maybe it'll be okay. I also, like, again, there's a matter of scale, right? Like, most of the shenanigans right now are going on Facebook. Well, I shouldn't even say that. There's a different audience. The shenanigans aimed at influencing the general public are mostly on Facebook. I would say the shenanigans aimed at influencing sort of elite media type of folks are mostly on Twitter. And again, I'm not necessarily talking like, you know, Russian state actions and spycraft and crazy things, although that clearly is still in play. I mean, even the Republican Senate committee report on this that came out like a month or so ago outlined some things that are ongoing to this day. The organization that Mueller indicted in Russia that does this stuff is still active. They're still doing stuff. And all kinds of other countries are doing it too. But I'm actually just as worried about the domestic actors doing this in completely legal ways. The final argument that is like, how effective is this stuff really? Does it really make a difference? I think that is still not well understood, because people can measure sort of direct effects, like how many people actually saw this particular post, but the indirect effects of how the overall conversation is steered, I think is very hard to figure out at this time still, and so very unclear. I think people are underestimating how much of an impact things can have. But at the same time, another important thing is I don't think these kinds of effects can move things by 20-30%. You know, you're not going to fundamentally take something that's a losing fringe idea and make it overwhelmingly popular. I don't think anything can do that kind of massive change, at least not in the short term. Maybe over the course of a number of years it could. But in the short term, no. But if you're talking about a closely divided population that's right on the edge between two ideas, can this kind of thing push it over the edge one way or the other? Yes, I think it absolutely could. I think it, you know, it was 2016 was close enough that this was one of many factors that potentially changed the outcome. Again, I hate the people who try to make it a single factor, because when the closer things are, the more it's true that everything made a difference. It's not just one thing. You can't pin it down to one thing. But yeah, I don't have an answer here, but I feel like neither Twitter or Facebook are where they need to be at this point. Is the answer government regulation? I don't know that I like that either. But I'd like the companies to be responsible in and of themselves, but that's not going to happen either. I think both of these companies, where their current stances are not, they're not going to solve the problem, and they will probably have unintentional consequences that make things potentially worse even. I don't know. We have yet to come to grips with the societal impact of the kinds of communication enabled by things like Facebook and Twitter at scale, and the easy ways that they can be manipulated, and the increasing sophistication over time of people being able to understand psychological vulnerabilities and take advantage of them, and in terms of how people think, what they react to, how to manipulate emotions, because emotions always trump facts. Even for those of us who love to think that we're all about facts, even with us, it's really all about emotions. So, on that lovely note, let me take another break and come back with just some really quick thoughts on a local election going on here. Back after this.
AlexMZWeb.com, being Alex and Dad. Gaming videos and more from Alex. Elementary school by day, YouTube by night, AlexMZWeb.com. Alex Mzilla is AlexMzilla, and .com is period and then com.
Okay, I'm back one last time, and I just wanted to talk local elections for a little bit, and very specifically one local election. So as I've mentioned on the show a couple times before, my wife is running for local office. Brandy Donaghy is running for South Snohomish County Fire and Rescue Fire Commissioner District 5. So, yeah, if you want to see something about that campaign, you can go to electbrandydonaghy.org. Now, I know most of you listening are nowhere near South Snohomish County, Washington, but, you know, take a look anyway. But if you are in South Snohomish County, Washington, take a look, and Brandy would appreciate your vote. I would appreciate your vote if you happen to be in our area. The ballots dropped a couple weeks ago. They're due this coming Tuesday, November 5th. And so get on it if you haven't already voted. I just wanted to say a few things about this. Well, first of all, go to our page. Stuff about our platform, endorsements. She's got lots of endorsements. Contact her if you want to ask more information. Fun stuff. But, you know, basically, I wanted to talk a little bit about the whole process. I've mentioned before on the show that local issues, local races are something that I've always had a really hard time even knowing what the hell is going on. Knowing who my local office holders are, knowing what local issues are. I'm very, very engaged in the national picture. And I think this is more and more true over time. I think, like, if you go back, people talk about, you know, Tip O'Neill's old comment about all politics is local. When he said that, I believe back in the 70s, maybe, was when that quote was from. Somewhere in there, plus or minus a decade. Maybe that was a lot more true. And people had a lot of very local connections and knew their local folks, and there was a local paper to read, I never had that experience, so maybe I'm wrong, but it seems like there was a period where that was more true. Now it seems everything is nationalized. We're always talking about national issues. We know what's going on nationwide. It seems knowledge of the local area is less and less common. And through the experience of my wife running for office, I've learned more about it. I've met more of these people. I know a little bit about what's going on locally and the issues that are local. But even then, it's hard. And it seems like this is a little bit of a problem. People should be more engaged locally. But it also seemed like something very, very hard to get into. But what I've watched with my wife over the last couple of years is that it really isn't. I mean, basically, after the 2016 election, she decided to get involved. She started out on a bunch of Facebook groups that she was talking to people about. She met some people there. She found some of the local meetings for for the local Democrats and other folks, the thing she's running for is nonpartisan, but she's also been involved in Democratic politics. She started showing up at the meetings. She started engaging. She started to talking to people. And before long, she knew all the people. Yeah, she knew all the folks who were doing things in local government. Maybe not all, that might be an exaggeration, but a lot. You know, she knows people who are involved in the county government, people involved in the state government, even people involved in the federal government. The three Congress people who are live close, you know, our own district and the two neighboring districts, they all would recognize her name and face, because she's been getting involved locally and shows up at their events and shows up at things that they're showing up to as well. And so it's actually not that hard a process to start finding out about these local events and local goings on. And it's probably something we should all do more of. And I still say that even, you know, like, I'm basically proxying off my wife. I'm not involved in these things directly. I know less of what's going on, but I talk to her and she can rattle off all kinds of things about local issues that are happening and how what the positions are of the various players and what they're doing. I don't know, but at least I have someone to ask at this point. Like, I'm about to go this weekend. I'm going to fill out my ballot here. I'm rattling it in front of a microphone right now. I'm going to fill out my ballot. I know I'm going to vote for my wife, but on all the other local issues that are on here, on many of them, I'm going to be like, Brandy, what's this about? Can you explain? Or who are these people? You know, is there one that you like? And if so, why do you like them? And so I can determine if I will agree. I'm not just going to automatically vote for everybody my wife likes, but local stuff is important, and it is harder than it used to get local information, but it's still out there if you want it. And it does seem important. The other thing I'll say about the local race is watching my wife do essentially the politician thing and going out with her has been incredibly instructive too. I mean, I've been out doorbelling with her, where we've just go to neighborhoods with lists of, you know, people who voted in previous elections and go knock on doors and leave pamphlets. And every, you know, once in a while, somebody actually answers the door, and they're universally friendly, which surprises me. Like, if somebody random knocks on my door, I hide. I don't even answer the door. But if I do answer the door, I don't want to talk to them. I'll be like, oh, I'll take your pamphlet. You know, I'm not mean or anything, but I don't want to talk to them. I don't want to have a conversation. But so many of these people actually want to engage and have the conversation. And, well, what is it you're running for? What do you believe in? What are you going to do if you win this office? Why do you think you're best for it? And, can you tell me a little bit about this role? Because, like, you know, what the hell does the fire commissioner do? You know, and, you know, I have these little mini conversations, and it's great stuff. And I've spent most of the last month, like, not doing other things, because every day after work, I've gone and I've put out signs at intersections, you know, vote Brandy Donaghy signs. And that's been interesting too, because, you know, people say, you know, yard signs and stuff, like, people try to, like, in presidential elections say, well, so-and-so is clearly going to win because he's got more yard signs. Yeah, that's bullshit. There's no correlation between the number of yard signs like that. However, it certainly for races like the presidential race, where by the time we get to election day, everybody knows what's going on. But for some of these local offices, yeah, you've never heard of them. You don't know who these people are. Name recognition really is a thing. And if you've get to your ballot and you recognize, oh yeah, I've seen their sign, that actually makes a difference. So yeah, I've been putting out lots of signs all over the area. You know, very, very, very exciting work. And I'm going to have to go pick them all up again after the election is over. And, you know, the voter pamphlet itself is also important, because, like, most people, that's all they'll ever see is that one little paragraph for these local offices. And so, yeah, it's been an interesting process. So as I wrap it up again, If you happen to be in South Snohomish County Fire and Rescue, go to electbrandydonaghy.org to see some information about her. You can contact her through there to ask more questions if you want. We do ask for your vote. That would be awesome. For everybody else, it's just like, I will say, my wife has been working incredibly hard on this. I'm so proud of her. Like, she's been working her ass off. I mentioned she's got a bunch of endorsements. She's got all the local Congress people. She's got a lot of, state senators, state representatives, the local sheriff, county and city council folks, that kind of thing. And she's been, doorbelling and putting out signs and all this kind of stuff. It takes work to do these kinds of things. And for positions like this position, if I understand it correctly, has like a stipend where if you go to one of the meetings, you get a nominal fee, but you're not making money off this. This is like, you're losing money to do this. It's a passion sort of thing. So I have newfound respect for some of these local office holders for what they do. And certainly I'm so proud of my wife. Win or lose, we'll see how this goes. There are no polls. I can't do an election graphs kind of thing for this election. No polls, no idea. She's running against an incumbent, so the incumbent has a natural advantage. She's got a ton of endorsements, and those people have been sending out mailers, so that's an advantage. Her name is listed first on the ballot, which apparently is also an advantage, which is sort of sad, but it is. We'll see. But fun stuff. Okay. Thanks, everybody, for making it through yet another Curmudgeon's Corner. Hopefully next week it won't just be me rambling on, and we'll talk about whatever new is in the news. For now, I need to wrap this up. My wife and I are taking my son Alex and his best friend Kalen to a movie from Dan TDM, who's a big gamer, who's a big YouTuber among the kids in the sort of 10-year-old range. So we're going to go have fun doing that. For everybody else, the usual. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/curmudgeonscorner. You can find me on Twitter @AbelSmay. You can find us on Patreon, patreon.com/curmudgeonscorner. If you give us money on Patreon, you can get all kinds of prizes, including being invited to the Curmudgeon's Corner Slack, which is lots of fun. We chat all week long about things. You can also get on the Slack by giving us feedback and engaging with us in other ways. The last way to get in touch with us is email feedback@curmudgeons-corner.com. We'd love to hear from you. And of course, tell your friends to subscribe to the show, leave reviews of the show. And I think that's it. Thanks, everybody. Have a great week. Talk to you next time. Goodbye.